The following is for your ears only. With our 30th anniversary broadcast, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
The politics of economics and the beep stakes. Romney and Obama spar over the slow recovery while pundits ponder running mates.
Inside the Sandusky scandal. Following a Pulitzer for breaking the story, a new book on the child abuse charges, and a campus culture of silence.
An even bigger anniversary. To help celebrate our 30 years, a look at the musical legacy of Burton Lane, born just over 100 years ago.
And more music for our celebration from singer Marilyn May, this year celebrating both her 84th birthday and seven decades in show business.
First words last, excerpts from our very first broadcast as Newsweek on air.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave.org, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of April 22nd, Earth Day 2012, and this show's 30th anniversary on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
The last thing we can afford to do is to go back to the very same policies that got us into this mess in the first place. That's part of what this election's all about.
He's going to be focusing on different Americans and trying to scapegoat other people for his own failures. You will see him attack success day in and day out. And one thing you know is if you attack success, you're going to have less of it.
Economic policy and the actual economic conditions Americans perceive clearly constitute the major battleground of the 2012 presidential campaign as former Massachusetts moderate Governor Mitt Romney solidifies Republican support for his contest with Barack Obama and a Democratic base not nearly as firm for him as 4 years ago. Big industrial donations are falling way off. But issues of special concern to the increasingly influential ranks of women and Latino voters and others most pained by a feeling of unfairness in the American system also remain key factors.
To look at the new state of the race, including increasing speculation about the vice presidential nomination in both parties, for your ears only, we're joined again by Princeton University Professor of History and Public Affairs, Julian Zelizer. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, Jimmy Carter, a biography, and now Governing America, the revival of political history from Princeton University Press. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
You recently wrote that the resolution of the presidential race into a Romney-Obama contest it tells us something unexpected about contemporary politics after all the complaints about crippling polarization.
Well, we always hear about red and blue America. We hear about a polarized political system where both parties can't get along and have fundamental disagreements. Yet both candidates this time around are going to be pragmatic problem solvers. Mitt Romney, famous for moving around on positions, for switching and not being loyal to certain party orthodoxies. And Barack Obama has been the same, constantly frustrating the left wing of his party. So the choice for both parties is not this stark red and blue America, but instead something in the middle.
To what extent do you think Romney should be moving away from a conservative social positions he aligned with during the campaign, some of which have been construed as a war on women? And can he, given constant pressures for purity from the Republican right, both around the country and in Congress, where some GOP leaders are saying they really set the agenda now?
He will have to move away from the base. This is going to be a game, meaning the election, about winning these swing states, winning moderate voters and disaffected Democrats. And Romney is going to have to stand firm and not move too far to the right on these kinds of questions, or he will play into the central attack Barack Obama looks like he is about to make, that Romney is in fact secretly an extremist, secretly part of the right wing of the party. So Romney will have to defy that and do what every other Republican president has done since Reagan, and that's run to the center, not run on the right.
Obama and Romney traded narrow leads in national polling last week. But could Obama's large edge among women and Latinos be decisive in maximizing their actual turnout?
It's complicated. I mean, on the one hand, the economy is clearly coming up in the polls as a huge vulnerability for President Obama and an opening for Mitt Romney to do well. This gender gap we've heard a lot about is a big problem for Republicans, and it's not a problem that's easily fixed. It's rooted in the policies of the GOP, and it's rooted in the basic composition of a lot of the organizations behind the party. The Latino vote's the most complicated. You know, there's other polls suggesting the economic downturn has really kind of made Latinos a population that's in flux. So all these polls, I think, show this and that, but this is an electorate in flux, and both candidates know that.
The Secret Service prostitution scandal in Colombia clearly overshadowed Obama's role there in the Summit of the Americas, where he clung to U.S. drug war policy, even while admitting it was debatable. So maybe it was something of a blessing. But as the scandal expands, do you see it having a political impact on the race, further undermining faith in government or at least government police power?
Well, I don't think it will undermine faith in government. What I do think it does is it takes attention away from other issues. So President Obama wanted to highlight his international economic policies and his international relations credentials, all these issues. That was why he went. But instead, we hear about Secret Service and agents with prostitutes. And so I think it's one of these issues that is very attractive for reporters to write about and talk about. It's very attractive for people to read about. And so the danger for Obama and Romney, frankly, is this really takes attention away from the kind of questions each candidate wants to focus on.
Relatively modest bail was set last week for George Zimmerman, the Florida Citizens Watch volunteer finally charged with second-degree murder for shooting unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. And there's a reasonable chance that Florida's stand-your-ground law could protect Zimmerman from prosecution. But the Justice Department is also looking into hate crime charges. And I wonder how you think that federal determination could affect presidential politics or vice versa.
Well, it could be important. I mean, President Obama really depended on the African-American vote, which was quite large last time around. This time, there's still African-Americans are very loyal to President Obama and overall pleased with him. But we don't know if it's the same kind of energy as the first time around. Will they all come out to vote? And, you know, issues like this that touch on race relations and continued racism in America do have the potential to stimulate higher turnout. But again, that's not a clear connection with this presidential race, so it's really hard to predict.
On the vice presidential front, you advised Romney to make a boring choice rather than one that solidifies the party's conservative base, as John McCain in part tried to do with Sarah Palin. Talk about that.
Look, the rule of thumb is vice presidential candidates can't really help a ticket, but they sure can hurt a ticket. And I think John McCain went for a game change, as the book was called and the movie, by picking Sarah Palin, trying to energize the base, trying to get media attention and excitement for his candidacy, and it really helped tank what he was doing. I think Mitt Romney needs a boring pick. He needs someone who won't steal the spotlight, who won't cause problems in a campaign that's relatively disciplined, and that won't, by playing to the base, remake what Romney's biggest virtue is, the ability is one of the few Republicans who does have the potential to reach to the center. And the worst for him would be to pick someone who plays to the base, and he looks like an extremist, and in the end loses the kind of votes that might have come his way.
On the Democratic side, there's talk again about replacing Joe Biden with Hillary Clinton, who's been working overtime as Secretary of State, God knows. Last week, she dismissed the idea. Quote, that's like saying if the Olympic Committee called you up and said, are you ready to run the marathon, would you accept? Well, it's not going to happen, Hillary said. What's your view on the wisdom and likelihood of any switch?
Well, you can see the wisdom. I mean, it could be very exciting, and if this gender gap is the kind of problem that we think it is, it could certainly, you know, really bring out a kind of vote for the Democratic Party that would be devastating for the Republicans. It doesn't look like Hillary Clinton wants to do it, and President Obama's team, I'm sure, is worried that by making the switch, they would look not as if they were doing something exciting, but as if they were concerned about their team. And whenever you have a shakeup historically, that's always a risk. So my guess is they're going to stay steady and really, again, focus not on the vice presidential candidate, but on President Obama himself.
Princeton University Professor of History and Public Affairs, Julian Zelizer. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, Jimmy Carter, a Biography, and Now Governing America, The Revival of Political History from Princeton University Press.
Quote from the news, light recovery blowing in a spring wind, dark clouds on the horizon. That was International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde on predictions of a downward economic trend as oil prices rise and stocks decline.
Next, the book on Sandusky and larger lessons of the case. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpin with this quote from the news. Neither side will receive everything it wants. That was the filing to a federal judge for a settlement of at least $7.8 billion negotiated by lawyers for BP and 100,000 victims of the Big Gulf oil spill 2 days before its second anniversary and on the eve of Earth Day 2012. Other court claims and penalty proceedings are still pending. Republicans in both houses of Congress, meanwhile, introduced bills to protect both foreign and domestic oil companies from any liability for deadly accidents in the future. Now this.
It's not from official. Oh, Sarah Ganim wins for Sandusky County. All right.
To me, this was a crime story. I'm a crime reporter, not a sports reporter. And this was a crime story that unfortunately we write often. But we did not see it unfolding with the, I think, reverberations that we did. And that's mostly because we were really focused on the story and not necessarily what it would mean.
The explosive Penn State child sex abuse scandal involving former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky was back in the news last week when reporter Sarah Ganim and members of the Harrisburg Patriot News won a Pulitzer Prize for breaking the story that a grand jury was investigating Sandusky and later that prosecutors were filing child sexual abuse charges against him. Those scoops were followed by stories about the alleged victims and how the matter was handled by Penn State administrators and officials with the Second Mile, a charity for youngsters founded by Sandusky.
The scandal led to the departure of legendary head football coach Joe Paterno, who died of lung cancer not long after, and criminal charges against two school administrators. Last week, too, there were reports of Penn State paying millions in cash and benefits to the Paterno family and of university officials asking for a delay in pretrial filings on their involvement in the scandal. For more on the case and its larger implications, for your ears only, we're joined by former Pittsburgh Post-Gazette investigative reporter Bill Mushi, now a professor in the School of Communication at Point Park University in Pittsburgh and co-author of the new book Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence from William Morrow. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
You've said the writing this book was one of the most difficult challenges you've ever taken on, in part, of course, because of the subject matter. Describe the greatest obstacles in trying to get sources and facts for the story.
Well, the people in what is known as Happy Valley, State College, PA, where Penn State's located, were not real happy to have the media badgering them as they looked upon it. So we had a lot of doors shut in our faces, phones hung up. People didn't respond to letters, but ultimately we found over 100 people that we interviewed for this book.
What do you see as the book's most important finding about the case?
Well, like Sarah Ganim said, is that they just stayed right with the story and not what it means. What we did was connect the dots from two points of view. One, the point of view of how this criminal matter unfolded, but more importantly, the issue of why and how this could go on for almost 12 years with repeated knowledge from various people in the Penn State administration. And it seemed like no one stood up to stop it until the matter got investigated from a high school 40 miles away from State College.
You've also highlighted how a book by Sandusky himself played a key role in the investigations, although one might have thought it would play that much earlier.
Jerry Sandusky's book is called Touched, and it provided the impetus for the investigation to move forward eventually, and it came because of this guy, Joe Leiter, a Pennsylvania state trooper.
Well, explain that.
Mr. Leiter he's now retired. He got involved when a kid from this place called Central Mountain High School broke down and told his mother and school officials that Sandusky had been molesting him for several years. For the first time, the investigation was getting handled by someone outside of Penn State, and this was Joe Leiter. And to the accusers, the 10 accusers, he became somewhat of a hero because he used Sandusky's book with names, only first names and some pictures, and traced backwards and found a bunch of folks. In fact, the ironic thing is that Sandusky's own words in his own book brought police upon him.
Ultimately, you say it was the insular nature of the university that allowed for this abuse to take place and to continue. Talk a bit about the secrecy surrounding the school.
Well, I mean, they make $53 million a year in profit in the football program. But aside from that, the Penn State University is found in the valley between two mountains, 200 miles from Pittsburgh, 200 miles from Philadelphia. It's basically in the middle of nowhere. And over the years, it's also the largest employer in that area. And basically, they have fought every public right to know inclusion that they would have been subjected to all the way through the legislature. Joe Paterno himself put a blue line around the football stadium and told his players, once you cross that line, it's our world and no one else's. Joe wouldn't ever let anybody, like reporters at practices. He felt like it was his deal, and he didn't owe any explanations to anyone. And sometimes when you get in these insular situations in this world, or like a cocoon, it gets eaten out from the inside. And that's why our book is a cautionary tale, and it's a must-read for people in universities and small towns, and companies that have all-encompassing power.
Penn State recently announced it was strengthening policies about the supervision and treatment of children who take part in university programs and those who are housed on campus. Did the school go far enough as the community sees it, and in your view?
You can't change overnight. The new administration has hired the former FBI director, Louis Freeh, to take a very close look at their entire regulatory process and also how they do things. And they're doing things from, like, there were three janitors who said they saw Sandusky with a child in a shower late at night when the team was out of town. And they eventually told police that they didn't come forward because they feared for their jobs. They were casual employees. They're reaching all the way down to the lowest level of employees and trying to teach people that they don't need to hide things like that. They've also put a bunch of other compliance types of things, and they're training virtually every employee on sexual abuse and related issues.
Well, what do you guess will be Sandusky's fate, given your understanding of the evidence?
There's 52 charges against Jerry Sandusky. There's 10 young men who are accusing him of appalling conduct. There are 5 or 10 others who say there are witnesses to the situation. I've covered over 200 trials in my life, and I've covered a bunch of child sexual abuse cases. And most of them are he said, she said stories where one person says something about someone else. But this is an overwhelming amount of evidence. And even Sandusky's own lawyer, before a gag order was issued, said that it's akin to climbing Mount Everest. So in my view, they might discredit some of the kids. They're going to try to discredit all of them since they don't have specific time and dates in some of the instances. But I would be surprised if something did not stick in light of the evidence that we've seen.
Former Pittsburgh Post-Gazette investigative reporter Bill Mushi is now a professor in the School of Communication at Point Park University in Pittsburgh and co-author of the new book Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State and the Culture of Silence, from William Morrow.
Quote from the news, what if the body was moved? That was Manhattan handyman Othniel Miller under renewed questioning about the disappearance of 6-year-old Eitan Pates that made national headlines in 1979 and put new focus on missing children. His remarks apparently led teams of police and FBI agents last week to dig up his former basement workshop for remains.
Next, celebrating a famous songwriter's 100th birthday on our 30th, for your ears only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. The butcher continues killing, the observers continue observing, and the people continue with their revolution. That was a protest poster in the Damascus suburb of Arbin as a promised ceasefire continues to unravel. Now this.
Something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon.
You may not know the name Burton Lane, but you probably know the songs he composed, Old Devil Moon and How Are Things in Glockamora from the Broadway musical and movie Finian's Rainbow, On a Clear Day You Can See Forever from the show and film of the same name, Too Late Now from the film Royal Wedding, perhaps most famous for Fred Astaire dancing on the walls and ceiling, and lesser-known classics like How About You from the film Babes on Broadway for Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, with one of my favorite verses. Life can be a joy when a girl meets boy, but the note they end on will depend on little pleasures they do share, so let us compare. I like New York in June. How about you?
Lane, who died in 1997, would have turned 100 this year. And to celebrate his centennial, cabaret singer, pianist, and music historian Eric Comstock has been performing a special show of his songs this week on Tuesday at the Triad Showroom on West 72nd Street in Manhattan. And with a stroll down that musical lane for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to have Eric on the line again now. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, David. Musical Lane. Very good.
Like many of the songwriters of the early 20th century, Lane studied classical piano. Tell us a little more about his early years and how he got into show business.
He was amazingly precocious. I think he set a record that still stands. When he was 18, these were the days, of course, when people didn't write entire Broadway scores. They interpolated songs into reviews and things. So it wasn't an all Rodgers and Hammerstein score, because we're talking about the 1930s. But Burton Lane, at 18, had songs in four Broadway shows, and then he had his first song in a film at 20. So extremely precocious. And I think it was in Atlantic City. His mother took him to Atlantic City, and he met the Gershwin brothers, who were, of course, idols of his. So he set his eye on the star and got there very, very fast.
We mentioned Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day, but his other stage musicals didn't quite rise to that level, and much more of his work was for Hollywood. What were some of the other films and their associated songs?
Well, you mentioned Babes on Broadway, so he was, you know, a contract player at MGM and wrote How About You for that. He worked at Paramount. He worked with Frank Lesser, and usually for, you know, not very good, very under par movies, but always excellent songs, many of which made the hit parade. A couple that I'll be doing are Says My Heart, which is from a movie called Coconut Grove with Fred McMurray. Barbara Fasano will be my very special guest. She'll be singing a beautiful song from College Humor with Bob Hope and Betty Grable and some other people, and that one is called Moments Like This, one of the sexiest songs maybe ever written.
It's a good thing she's also your wife.
I left that to you to say. I think of her as a great singer as well.
Lane is also credited with bringing the girl who would become Judy Garland to Hollywood's attention.
That's right. He actually played the audition of Frances Gum at MGM, and we all know she grew up to be Tracy Bennett.
Can you describe the typical characteristics of a Burton Lane melody or what it is about them that particularly appeals to you?
I think he did it all, and I really think it's criminal that he isn't more highly regarded outside the Carnegie like you guys are, because he wrote extremely elegant melodies. He really wrote sinuous, beautiful, that are equally loved by song mavens and jazz musicians. And the goal of my show at the Triad Theater this Tuesday is that, in addition to Barbara Fasano, I'll be working with my trio and to show the jazz possibilities of these songs. They're so versatile. Certainly, Old Devil Moon has taken its place in the jazz canon, and Too Late Now that you mentioned, which is on my most recent record called Bittersweet, is beloved of jazz musicians. The harmonies are so irresistible; they go to inevitable places, but not cliche places.
Lane's collaborator on Finian's, Yip Harburg, could go pretty heavy on the politics in his lyrics. Do we know much about Lane's politics?
Lane was not as outspoken as Yip Harburg and therefore did not wind up on the blacklist in the 1950s. But both Burton and his wife, Lynn, who will be with us on Tuesday at the Triad, Lynn and Burton were very involved in civic affairs here in New York and very of the left. But obviously, Burton, even if he, I'm not sure he had the temperament, even if he were a lyric writer, that he would have incorporated his views into the lyrics, as Yip Harburg so outspokenly did. I mean, when you think about it now, even now, Finian's Rainbow looks very risky. It was 1947. They had an integrated chorus, and it was a very leftist message and certainly addressed issues of race. A long time ago, and with a hit anyway.
Given how long Lane lived into the late years of the last century, do we know what he made of the way popular music was changing? Some of the old masters, like Irving Berlin, were reportedly quite heartbroken.
Yes, I think the same would be true for Burton. Burton kept trying to get another hit, and I think Berlin had the best line about that when he said, I feel like I'm a merchant and I've got lots of good stuff on the shelves and nobody's coming in. And I think Burton Lane did feel that music was about giving beauty to the world and, you know, it's all a matter of taste and obviously great songs are written in all eras. But it did discourage him that there was less demand for his material in the later years of his life.
Eric Comstock sings the songs of Burton Lane at 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 24th at the Triad Showroom on West 72nd Street in New York, including this.
Of the morning breeze up there, the rattle of the milkman on the stair. Sure, that's music, mighty fine music. The singing of a sparrow in the sky, the perking of the coffee right nearby.
Quote from the news, my greatest asset in life was I never lost touch with hot dogs, hamburgers, going to the fair and hanging out at the mall. That was music and broadcasting king Dick Clark, host of rock popularizing American Bandstand and numerous New Year's Rockin' Eve TV specials, dead last week at 82.
Next, celebrating 7 decades of singing. More music for your ears only.
Another verse for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. If it doesn't come from your heart, music just doesn't work. That was singing drummer Levon Helm, formerly of The Band, who died last week at age 71. Now this.
Good times and bad times. I've seen them all, and my dear, I'm still here. Plush bell, but sometimes just pretzels and beer. But I'm here.
There are a few cases of singer and song fitting more hand in glove than Marilyn May's version of I'm Still Here by Stephen Sondheim. And like our own show this week, she's celebrating a birthday. Two, in fact. At age 84, she begins her annual birthday run at Feinstein's Cabaret and Lowe's Regency Hotel on Park Avenue, New York. And this year is also the 70th in her career as a radio, television, theater, concert, and cabaret artist with numerous honors and tidal waves of audience adoration along the way.
May's new show is titled The Happiest Sound in Town. And to talk about it and her extraordinary career, for your ears only, Marilyn May is on the line now. Welcome to our 30th anniversary show.
Thank you, and congratulations. That's an incredible record for radio.
It is.
Isn't that fabulous?
You began taking music lessons from your mom at age 3, voice lessons at 9, and at 14 you sang for 2 famous songwriters, Hugh Martin and Ralphie Blaine, who wrote Meet Me in St. Louis, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, and many more. How did that audition come about?
Well, it really wasn't an audition. Actually, my cousin, who was like my sister, was a star. Joy Hodges was her name, and she was a Broadway, actually Universal Pictures starlet, and in the late 30s, and she was starring in a show called Best Foot Forward, and they, of course, wrote that, the music for that. She was appearing in a theater close. I was living in Des Moines, and her mother and I, my aunt and I, went to Chicago. She was appearing in a theater in Chicago doing Best Foot Forward, and they were with her, and she said, I want you to hear my little cousin sing. And I got up on the stage with a work light after the show was over late in the evening, and a little girl sang for them. I think I sang a cappella. I'm not sure that there were any musicians around to play for me. So it was a thrill, and as years went on, Ralph Blaine and I became very dear friends. He moved after he retired from his songwriting career. He moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Tulsa has a great symphony orchestra, or had a great symphony orchestra, and I used to work with them a lot, and Ralph came to one of my performances, and he said, I remember you, and because of Joy Hodges and all that. So we became friends later in life. It's kind of fun how you pick up right where you left off.
But not long after that, playing for them, as I gather, even as a teenager, you had your own radio show. Did that bring admiration or jealousy from teenage pals?
Well, they used to go. It was in the days when you would work, you know, behind the glass, and there were large windows, and people could stand outside the studio and watch you, do the radio show. And they would stand out there, and then afterward we would go for burgers, and I was very popular because usually I bought the burgers.
Working out of Chicago, you've said you played every Moose and Elks Club in the state of Illinois. Was it fun or a little frightening to be trekking around the country as the girl singer that every guy thought was singing love songs just to him?
Oh, I like that, because I've always sung to the audience, not for them. And actually, I went into Chicago. There were lots of booking agents. As soon as I got out of high school, I went from Des Moines, Iowa, where I lived, to Chicago, Illinois, where there were lots of booking agents. And the bookings were in very strange clubs. You would take trains. I'm that old that I would get on the train and go to some place in Illinois, some Moose Club, and sing for a week or two. And, it's the beginning of a career.
One guy who took a shine to you also shone a spotlight on you on his television show. Tell us about becoming a favorite of the great comedy and talk show host Steve Allen.
Oh, I loved Steve. He was very good to me. I was working in Kansas City in one club. In fact, I worked one club in Kansas City for 11 years. And during that time, I did a local recording, which was sent around to various record companies. Steve at that time owned Pacific Jazz Records, and he heard my recording of it and just called out of the clear blue sky. Someone answered the phone and said, there's someone named Steve Allen. I said, I don't know any Steve Allen. And I picked up the phone and I heard that voice and I thought, oh my God, it's the Steve Allen. And he said, I want you to come out and do my prime time show. At that time, he had a show, I think it was on Sunday at 8 o'clock, and I did that show many times. And then later on, he had a show in the Hollywood Ranch Market area, and I went out a lot and did that. As years went on, we did a succession of one-nighters, Steve and I and Bill Dana and Louis Nye. And in fact, I was just at the McCallum Theater last week in Palm Springs, and that's where our tour, we did four tours of one-nighters with Steve and that those comedy men, and we started the tours at the McCallum Theater, so it was very nostalgic to go back to that theater. Steve was fabulous to work with. He loved music. He understood what the singer was doing, and it made it a joy to be with him.
And later, you became actually a record regular on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. Beyond pure musicianship, every critic writes about the sheer energy you bring to your singing. And I'm wondering, what kind of health and exercise regimen do you follow to stay at that peak?
I take vitamins, David. I just take vitamins and keep packing and unpacking. That's great exercise. And stairs and airports, and you know, just my theory is just keep moving, and that keeps you healthy. Attitude, I have a great attitude. I'm hardly ever ill, and I think positively about my work and my life.
Marilyn May's annual birthday show is the happiest sound in town from April 24th through May 5th at Feinstein's Cabaret in Manhattan's Loews Regency Hotel.
Here's a quote from the news. I wish you'd bite me on the neck. That was a typical fan letter to Jonathan Frid, who played vampire Barnabas Collins on TV's Dark Shadows, and a cameo role in the new Tim Burton movie version, before his death last week at age 87.
Next, saving the first for last, excerpts from the launch of this broadcast 30 years ago this week, for your ears only.
Now, a 30th anniversary trip down memory lane for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
And I'm David Alpern with an encore of excerpts from the very first broadcast of this program, launched April 25th, 1982, as Newsweek on Air on the RKO Radio Network with first co-host Gil Gross. Then, and on our 25th anniversary show in 2007, hosted, as this week, by Catherine and me.
The presses are rolling at Newsweek, and we'll be talking to the reporters, the columnists, and the newsmakers who are featured in Newsweek this week.
I'm Newsweek senior editor Dave Alpern.
And I'm RKO correspondent Gil Gross. Welcome.
Our very first story was on a crisis still confounding us.
No more war, no more bloodshed, no more bereavement. Peace unto you. Shalom, salam forever.
When Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and the late Egyptian President Anwar Sadat reached a peace agreement with U.S. President Jimmy Carter at Camp David, it began a new era of relationships in the Middle East. But with Israel's formal return of the Sinai Desert to Egypt this weekend, that era is ending, and there are very serious questions about what will happen next.
We have Newsweek diplomatic correspondent John Walcott on the line with us from Washington. John, with the Sinai going back to Egypt now, what do you see as the biggest roadblock to a Middle East peace?
Well, obviously, Gil, the biggest roadblock is the Palestinian problem. And I think it's important to recognize that the Palestinian problem and the invasion of Lebanon that you and Mike were just chatting about are very closely related. Since Camp David, the United States, Israel, and Egypt have been trying to negotiate some form of self-government for the over a million Arabs who live on the West Bank and in Gaza. They've gotten nowhere. The United States has never really pushed that idea hard. And as a result, Prime Minister Begin and Defense Minister Sharon have really been free to pursue their own policy on the West Bank, which amounts to extending a form of second-class citizenship to the Arabs who live there. The problem with doing that is the PLO. The PLO resists. The PLO is armed. It has an ability to kill Israeli soldiers and Jewish settlers. It's controlled from Lebanon. So ultimately, if you're going to pacify the West Bank in the fashion that Begin seems to want to, you have to destroy the PLO where it lives, which means you have to go into Lebanon.
Israel did occupy Lebanon for years, but ultimately had to withdraw. The Palestinian problem remains.
The first Newsweek on Air also considered a looming war between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands and a familiar battle over the federal budget.
For more than a month now, the White House and congressional leaders have been trying to work out a compromise on President Reagan's proposed budget for the coming fiscal year. For a while last week, it seemed that they might come up with something, but time and again, the announcement was postponed, and in the end, it seemed that a detailed deal would be put off until at least this coming week, maybe indefinitely. David, seems to be a kind of a spectator sport to many Americans. There's a lot riding on a resolution of this budget fandango, the state of the nation's economy, interest rates, money available for social programs, and the size of the bite each of us has taken from the IRS.
That's true. And to shed some light on the problems preventing a budget settlement, we've got the White House correspondent Eleanor Clift on the line now and congressional correspondent Gloria Borger. Eleanor, at the beginning of the week, it seemed that the White House was beginning to show a little more willingness to tamper with President Reagan's original budget proposal. What prompted that flourish of flexibility?
Well, I think that flexibility has been present for a couple of weeks, if not months, as Ronald Reagan sees the economy deteriorating around him. And I believe there is broad agreement on the part of those that are negotiating, Democrats, Republicans, on what needs to be done. The problem is politics. I think the Democrats are about to conclude there's more in it for them come the November congressional elections if they don't bail Ronald Reagan out on the economy. And I think we may see a stalemate.
Gloria Borger, politics aside, is there a personality problem between these two most important figures in the budget debate, the president and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill?
Well, Tip O'Neill is always the first to tell you that Ronald Reagan is a fine fella and that after 6 o'clock at night they get together and get along very well. I think the problem here is that they have some very, very basic differences on their attitude towards government.
There were lighter topics, too, on that first show. Atlanta's winning baseball Braves, Knoxville's World's Fair, and black comic Richard Pryor.
Because I was watching TV, man. I was all bandaged up, and they said I was going to die. They said, Richard Pryor died 5 minutes ago. Ooh, no!
Richard Pryor set himself ablaze one day while freebasing, making a potent batch of cocaine. He says that brush with death has changed him, but he also says he still hears the coke demon lurking nearby, saying, that's okay, Rich. I'll take care of you. This is a man who shot up his car, said a girlfriend's mink stole on fire, went to jail on a tax charge, has had fist fights with his co-stars, been through 4 marriages, and has used language on TV and on stage that would make a sailor's parrot blush. But he is also just about the hottest performer around. Richard Pryor is our Newsweek cover story this week, and Los Angeles correspondent David Friendly is with us to talk about him. David, tell us something about the background of Richard Pryor. Where does he come from that would help explain where he gets his sense of humor?
His roots are as unlikely, I think, as his success today. He's from Peoria, Illinois, and he goes back to that often. He grew up not as a poor, struggling black man as one might think from his comedy, but in a fairly middle-class upbringing. And I think his success is just so surprising to so many people today, and they view him as a real overnight success when, in fact, he's been in this business for more than 2 decades now.
We tried adding a little humor of our own.
We would have played more Richard Pryor, but the FCC still licenses a lot of radio stations.
It's called Pryor Restraint.
Joining us now is the original co-host of Newsweek on Air, Gil Gross, currently an anchor with ABC Radio News in Los Angeles. Gil, what do you remember most about that first show in the early years of Newsweek on Air?
You know, what I remember about it is the two of us being given this assignment and just sort of sitting over coffee in the Newsweek building, inventing this thing. I have since worked on programs for large networks with tons of consultants that have expired after 3 months. I'm just thinking how funny it is the two of us came up with this thing that lasted 25 years.
Hey, Gil, we made it to 30, with more to come as For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and feedburner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davideearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
Our 30th anniversary broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at Hanger Studio. With interns Daniela Quintanilla and Rachel Murray, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with support from nonprofit Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment. Normally a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Rachel Murray. This week we go back to our 25th anniversary show, whose big story was the campus massacre at Virginia Tech, from our April 22, 2007 Newsweek on-air broadcast, hosted by Catherine and David.
You just loved crucifying me. You loved inducing cancer in my head, terrorizing my heart, and ripping my soul all this time.
Out of concern for Cho, officers asked him to speak to a counselor. He went voluntarily to the police department. Based on that interaction with the counselor, a temporary detention order was obtained and Cho was taken to a mental health facility.
Even with the multimedia manifesto he took time from his senseless killing spree to send, the mind of Cho Sung-hui remains a muddled mystery at Virginia Tech and beyond. Clearly, the concern of fellow students and teachers, conveyed many times to school authorities, were not enough to prevent Cho's purchase of automatic handguns and last week's worst-ever mass shooting on campus, 33 victims, including himself. Nor was his brush with local law enforcement and mental health experts, as reported by VT Police Department Chief Wendell Flincham. In the end, there were prayers and tears at various campus vigils and ceremonies, as we heard, and a mountain of questions about what mixture of biology, psychology, and social factors led the 23-year-old South Korean student to explode so violently.
The massacre also renewed the long-standing debate over gun control and over what changes in law, police practice, and safety procedures around the country should be made to better deal with murderous madness that is more common than most Americans like to admit. Within days, a contract worker snuck a gun into Houston's Johnson Space Center, killed another man, and duct-taped a woman to her chair for hours before shooting himself. And yet a new AP Ipsos poll showed continuing division over gun laws, with only 48% saying they should be tightened, 38% wanting no change, and 11% favoring even fewer restrictions, arguably so more people could defend themselves.
For more on all this, we have Newsweek science specialist Sharon Begley and Dr. Britt Minshall, a law enforcement veteran turned psychologist and minister. After the break, we'll focus on gun control with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's criminal justice coordinator, John Feinblatt.
First to Sharon. Start by distinguishing between what scientists call reactive and proactive killers.
Well, Catherine, these are two types of murderers. The proactive is one who carefully plots what he is going to do, and you hesitate to call it rational, so let's at least call it thought out. And it's a murder committed in advance of some particular goal. A bank robbery would be a typical example. Reactive murderers, in contrast, are those who are responding to perceived or real slights and injuries and resentments, and they are therefore responding to something that has happened to them in the world. And it's the reactive killers who seem to be just biologically, neurobiologically different from normal people.
Once there was talk about a gene for violence, but now science says genetics and biology only set the stage. What parts of the brain are involved and how, especially with these reactive killers?
The reactive killers show very low activity in the frontal cortex. That's the region just behind your forehead. This is the area that controls high-level so-called executive functions such as planning and judgment, controlling impulsivity, thoughtfulness, sort of self-censoring. And again, these are quite low in activity in these reactive killers. In contrast, in reactive killers, the emotion regions of the brain, these are the limbic regions, are on overdrive. They light up the brain imaging technology. So the combination of the two, again, high emotionality and apparently a diminished ability to control those impulses and to be thoughtful and to exercise mature judgment, that's just a tinderbox of a combination.
And how does life experience affect the brain to further increase the likelihood of violence?
Well, that's the area, Catherine, where science has really advanced. It used to be thought that you could explain a horror like this by invoking genes or some brain abnormality or some life experience such as abuse or, even playing video games. But what's become clear, and this is really where science has made its greatest progress, is that you require the interaction of all of these things. So yes, there might be some genetic predisposition toward a difficulty with impulse control or being more aggressive, but it doesn't manifest itself. It doesn't turn into anything dangerous or bad unless you have a particular series of life experiences of how your parents treat you, how your teachers treat you, how you interact with your friends and peers. Those experiences either allow the gene to be expressed or quiet it down. And similarly, as you go on in life, the experiences that you have as you get older, again, those either reinforce or can quiet down what would be an innate tendency. So, again, you can't just blame anyone's murderous spree on a single cause anymore.
Newsweek Sharon Begley. Next to Dr. Britt Minshall and what some see as the system failures on display last week. Dr. Mitchell, even if police had reason to assume a gunman in the two earliest shootings had fled, was it wise to leave other buildings unprotected?
Absolutely not, David. You have a situation where the gunman, you said it yourself, they assumed that he had fled. Well, the question is, where did he flee to? He obviously was not on the scene. They did not have the murder weapons, and they did not have the perpetrator. At that moment, they should have assumed that he was somewhere within the university or right close into the town.
So should school officials have imposed a lockdown on campus?
Absolutely. That's the first thing as I began to look at this thing last Monday morning.
Yep.
I started to look at this around 10 o'clock, and the first question I had in my mind is, since it took place at 7:15, by 7:25, local radio stations and the two local television stations should have been putting a streamer across the bottom. Attention, please. The school is closed until noon. There has been a shooting. Please do not come to the campus. And then the state police could have easily cordoned off the main entrance. It's not a city school like Boston University.
Well, beyond the question of the lockdown, you've even raised questions about the campus memorial service.
Well, it leans all the way back, David, to the operating philosophy that I seem to see playing out here. That's the kind of stuff that we teach in group dynamics when we go into these organizations. And you very often have, in today's day and age, management teams which are gathered together using the operating philosophy of institutional survival. That's what the dog food people did. You have a shooting at 7:30 in the morning. Nobody notifies anybody until 10 o'clock. It would seem to be that the board or whoever was in control, all the management team, was saying, firewall this, damage control, keep it down. To prove it, 24 hours later, you have this immense national multimedia event. It's marvelous. It's a cheerleading session. It maybe would have been great Friday or Saturday or Sunday, but not the next day. Many of the people hadn't even been notified that their sons and daughters were killed yet. Mm-hmm. And now you're going to have this big service. It was most inappropriate, not good for the grieving process.
Dr. Britt Minshall is a minister, counselor, social psychologist, and law enforcement veteran. We also spoke with Newsweek science columnist Sharon Begley.
Madness and Massacre, from our April 22nd Newsweek on-air broadcast. Last week marked the first time since the shooting that classes at Virginia Tech were not canceled for the anniversary. We felt that being in classes was one special way of remembering victims from the university community, said Provost Mark McNamee. Last month, two victims' families who had accused the school of negligence were awarded $4 million each by a jury. And that example, experts agreed, was helping to persuade other schools to adopt multi-platform warning systems of a shooter on campus, better coordination with local police, and increased sensitivity to psychological time bombs. I'm Rachel Murray. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now more Marilyn May with an anthem of tranquility.
It's a lazy afternoon, and the beetle bugs are zooming, and the tulip trees are blooming, and there's not another human in view but us two. It's a lazy afternoon, and the farmer leaves his reaping in the meadow, cow sleeping, and the speckled trout stop leaping upstream as we dream. A fat pink cloud hangs over the hill, unfolding now like a rose. If you hold my hand and sit real still, you can hear the grass as it grows. It's a hazy afternoon, and I know a place that's quiet, except for daisies running riot
and there's no one passing by it to see. Come spend this.